Good afternoon. My name is Roxanne Bogutska, and I'm a science instruction librarian based at the Life Science Library, and I'd like to welcome you all to Research Plus Pizza, a lunchtime lecture series featuring research presentations by faculty from across our university. Please help yourself to drinks and also to pizza over here on the right that is courteously and generously supplied by our supporter, Austin's Pizza, so yay for them. If you're in line getting your drinks, the water and diet beverages are on the left cooler and the regular stuff is on the right. Okay. We are recording this, just as a notice, this will be recorded for a podcast. So when we get to the Q&A at the end of Matt Ficus's presentation, I'll be wandering around with this microphone. So if you have a question, toss your hand up in the air and I'll come and bring the microphone to you. Okay. This is the University of Texas Library's second installment of Research Plus Pizza, and it features the director of the School of Architecture's state-of-the-art facade thermal lab, Matt Ficus, who's going to talk about sustainable architectural design strategies focusing on building envelopes and efficient facade systems. He received a Master's of Architecture from Harvard Graduate School of Design and a Bachelor of Science in Architecture from the University of Texas at Arlington. He worked in London for 4 years at Foster and Partners and also worked for Max Levy Architect in Dallas, Brinkley Sargent Architects in Dallas, Julie Snow Architects in Minneapolis, and Mario Correa Arquitectos in Barcelona, and he's a licensed architect in the state of Texas. He's been a visiting critic and lecturer at the Architectural Association in London, the University of Lund, Sweden, the Arkitektskole of Aarhus, Denmark, the Chalmers Technical Institute in Gothenburg, Sweden, and the École Spéciale d'Architecture in Paris. His research informed his part in the collaborative design of the Home Research Lab, built as part of the Pecan Street Smart Grid experiment to integrate scientific research with sustainable living strategies for the public. I also want to encourage you to visit the Fine Arts Library, where there is a More Than Architecture exhibit that will be going on throughout the month. It includes a display of one of his projects, a yet-to-be-built Bat House Visitor Center. This image here is the Bat House Visitor Center. So go to the Fine Arts Library webpage, and you'll see a link about the More Than Architecture exhibit that will be going on through the month, and that has a reception on Friday evening. So be sure to check that out. And now, without further ado, please welcome Matt Ficus.
Okay, so I struggled to think of a topic for this talk today, and I knew it was going to be a very broad audience, so I wasn't sure how to frame this very well. But I ultimately titled it Skin Deep, which is often a phrase used to describe something very superficial without much substance. But in architectural design, the facade or the skin of the building is actually quite a critical thing. And so considering the fact that we spend 90% of our time indoors in this country and that buildings consume 50% of all energy that's used, we tend to think of SUVs as being a big culprit, and they are. But buildings are a huge energy consumer as well. So it's and then the building facade, the building envelope, or the crust of the building is what actually allows for the most heat transfer, obviously. So I'm gonna show a bit from the thermal lab. I'll speak about the thermal lab very generically, and one student project related to that. And I'm also going to speak about a second project that I'm involved in as well. I first wanted to mention something that I think is quite critical to set up a discourse. In architectural history, classicism was defined by symmetry and overall geometric priorities, where the form was more important than function. So whether or not you would need to have four separate entries to your house and need to have four foyers and need to have four equal bedrooms or not, classicism would drive that, and being symmetrical on all axes was more important than function. Modernism then challenged that and said, well, perhaps function should be driving the proportion of spaces and the relationship between them. So perhaps the living room and the terrace might be larger, and the bathrooms and the service storage areas might be smaller. And what I propose is that in the future, that actually energy And light and energy will actually supersede function and form to the extent that there will be no set visual standard for what we can expect buildings to begin to look like. Rather, it will be about creating very specific environments based on light needs and thermal needs. So the thermal lab is essentially a 12-foot cube that exists very near the School of Architecture on the back of the West Mall building. And this was built by Professor Werner Long just before I came here. So I luckily sort of inherited this. And essentially it's a highly insulated box on all sides except the south facade, which allows for window treatment testing or facade testing of a south-facing window. So if you control everything else, you know that the only place where light and heat can be exchanged is on that south facade. This is a shot inside looking to the north where all the equipment is housed so that you can monitor on a very granular level. You can have heat sensors peppered throughout the space as well as on the inside of the glass, the outside of the glass, the inside of a shading structure, so on and so forth. So I wanted to show one student project. This is a student thesis project, which was interested in examining if there might be a shading structure that could be better than the typical shading structures we see of vertical louvers and horizontal louvers. And it first began with an analysis of horizontal and vertical louvers and egg crate louvers and understanding how these work and how they perform in terms of daylight and thermal performance. And by getting a sense of a baseline of how those perform, then trying to propose something that might actually not only allow a better light quality, but actually allow more view. Because the problem with louvers quite often is that the view is quite marginalized. It's not considered very, very carefully. So what was developed was a version of a honeycomb structure, which would allow for optimized views at standing and seating level, and then minimizing heat gain within. So as we all know from this past heat wave, there are 6 months of the year in this climate when you don't want any direct sun to come in through windows or you'll quickly overheat. So it was a critical balance of trying to optimize view but then minimize the amount of direct sunlight, yet still have diffuse light, light that bounces off of the shading structure. So through a series of iterations using different softwares, the student was able to derive this and then actually build the, well, this is still a digital model test. But the honeycomb structure, I should say really quickly, there were three basic reasons why that was chosen. One was that that geometry loosely mimics the geometry of the movement of the sun throughout the day. Also, it's structurally efficient through triangulation. So often you'll see diagonal members and steel structures to help reinforce for lateral reinforcement. And then it's also a stackable module. So if you think as opposed to a circle, for example, the faceted geometry of the honeycomb allows it to stack and be quite efficient in terms of material usage. So it was actually made. It was actually cut out of a form of plastic called polypropylene. At the School of Architecture, it was CNC routed and actually built up on the platform and then installed. And the results showed that it performed as well in terms of light and thermal exchange as any of the conventional shading structures, but that it allowed better views and used less material. So it was an interesting first stab. It was a very promising first stab at trying to optimize the way that we can design shading structures. I should mention that it's in this specific climate. This isn't meant to be a universal solution everywhere. And having said that, what's important is that part of the study dealt with we had to worry about comparative analysis. So at the moment, you can see there's a gap up here. This platform was built just for the lab. And there's a twin lab starting construction next month. And the purpose of that is to have dual comparative analysis so that you can understand on the exact same day with the exact same weather conditions that one structure performs can you hear me? I'm getting voice. Okay, yeah. So one structure performs, you know, X, another structure performs Y. At the moment, what we have to do is you have to do a test 1 week and then take that down and then do the control test the next week or vice versa. And then you have to kind of figure out what the difference was between the weather those 2 different weeks. So That will be a very big improvement upon our analysis once we get the second lab built. This is just a shot during graduation. There's no testing going on here. So I want to speak really briefly about a project. So in line of thinking about building skins, and this being a little more speculative and conceptual, but a project that I designed, then thinking about what if we were to try to optimize a building skin. If you basically distilled a small house, a 400 square foot house, down to just being structure and skin, what might you be able to do? If you begin to think of, imagine this is a cross section through a small house, and you imagine having a very thick skin where you could plug in different types of insulation or different types of light modulating devices, as well as your own belongings, and actually use that as an instrument to manipulate light. And this was driven by a competition by Habitat for Humanity, which was interested in trying to design a 400 square foot house for two adults that could basically exist in various climates around the world. So the idea was that you'd have this starter frame, and you could plug in regional materials into any context, and so you would have a consistency among all the various houses in that region, but then a variety by the personal belongings that are inserted in different parts of the thick skin. So I'm not going to speak in much detail about this, but it was an interesting exercise to try to understand what might you be able to do with manipulating the structure to allow for a bit of an undulating landscape, because you would obviously need to have a bit of, you can't have walls in a 400 square foot house, or you quite quickly block everything up. So how would you begin to suggest different programmatic functions? And then, I won't speak about this too much, but also then did a light study based on taking that same form and then imagining punched windows, which is what one would typically expect in any residential application, and then curtain wall windows, which you typically expect in an office, or more similar to here. And then proposing this hybridized filter wall, which would actually modulate light in a more scattered manner. And then did an illuminance mapping. And it's not too surprising that this top row being a typical window condition where you would expect. So this is showing essentially the light levels in plan, looking from above in that house. And so understand that you have some very hot spots here, but then quite darker spots and when you have the punched windows. And of course, when you have all open, you have quite a lot of, or too much light, actually. And so what's interesting here is you create a bit of a varied landscape that looks a bit like Mark Rothko paintings, which, as I was saying before, perhaps instead of having buildings that dictate our behavior, instead you have an envelope which allows for a variety of experiences, and then you can migrate around the space depending upon what light level you would need at any given time or temperature, variations of temperature among any given zone. So this geometry is really not significant. It's more about creating an atmosphere where the building skin can and the building envelope can allow for a variety of experiences by manipulating natural light. So again, coming full circle back to this speculative progression here. So lastly, I wanted to speak about a project that I'm working on that's related to the Pecan Street Project, which is a very large entity, but it's funded by a grant from the Department of Energy, and a lot of our effort has been to create a, what we're calling, it's changed names many times. The etymology of the project is as interesting as the project itself in some ways, but at the moment I call it the Living Lab. The client disagrees now, but I'm going to call it the Living Lab mostly, but sometimes it's called the Home Research Lab, sometimes it's called the Pike Powers Lab. But it was meant to be a demonstration of sustainable living in the Mueller development, so a bit of a model home, but then it's also an actual active laboratory. So NREL, the National Renewable Energy Lab, out of Boulder, Colorado, this will be their Austin seat. This will be where they'll actually use the facilities here to test sustainable technologies, as will UT researchers and skillsmen from ACC. So to give you a bit of context, those of you who aren't familiar with Mueller, if this is downtown, this is UT. Mueller is the old airport in Austin, which is quite close to downtown. And you can still see the old runway. It's being developed into a sustainable mixed-use community, which one of the main sustainable features is high density. And so by having quite small lots, it makes a very walkable community and a lot more. So people still have their private property, but they also have a quicker access to parks and more and public facilities. So, well, I should mention here that we managed a large part of this was trying to figure an appropriate lot because it has a bit of a private function to it, but it also has a public accessibility issue. It was meant to be a demonstration, visitable by the public at certain times. And so it needed to be in a residential context, but needed to be accessible. And we managed to get a lot that's directly across from the old control tower from the 60s, which is being preserved. Actually, as a quick side anecdote, Quentin Tarantino wanted to blow this down, explode this tower. I think when he was filming Machete here, and it managed to be saved by people rallied around and saved it. But it's a fantastic old piece and a bit of an orientation device as well. So we thought within a very large development, to have this orientation device to the actual Living Lab site was critical. So we have almost an east-west orientation. It's not quite true east-west. But and this particular lot was master planned to be a shop house lot, which means work live essentially, where you have light commercial on the ground floor and two stories of residential above. It's a very European model, but quite new to the US. So the idea, the way the master planners had drawn this out was that you would have the three-story unit, the commercial and residential above, on Berkman, and then have a one-story detached garage in the back. All that really left you was a very small, sort of ping-pong-sized yard, really, because these are 20 by 80-foot lots. So it's only 1,600 square foot, the entire lot. And we needed to build a 2,500 square foot of program there. So the strategy was to actually treat that base all as one large plinth or podium, where you bring you pull the garage and that commercial area, which will be lab for our purposes initially. And then you allow for a large roof terrace on top. So you have both a large sort of end piece or bookend to the block to hold that down, and then you also have an amenity on top. Though it's a lab in the short run, it eventually is meant to become will be sold as a residence down the road. So we needed to be careful to safeguard for this being a residence. And so it was a nice feature to be able to distill the two and have a difference between the actual podium below and the two-story residence articulated and floating above that. So this is one of the earlier renderings where we're beginning to imagine this lab or commercial zone below and the two-story residence up above. In terms of materials, there were obviously many things we were considering in this. One was thinking about this. We found this material called bioaluminum, which is essentially recycled aircraft aluminum, which we thought was very fitting to be directly across from the old control tower in the airport and to be sort of a reincarnated airplane floating above this plinth. And then we used several other strategies. So in order to have an occupiable roof terrace here, there really isn't much room for any sort of yard, so instead we proposed a vertical garden on the core, which was quite substantial, the core, because it needed to house the stairs, an elevator, an accessible elevator, and many other service features. We have a ductless HVAC system, so the vertical garden helps to cloak that a bit, and then also to act as a bit of a nice feature as well. So this being the view on Antone, that's Berkman just beyond there, and you can see the control tower, and there's meant to be a park surrounding that. So, of course, this is still a rendering, this is still a drawing. But it's meant to start construction this fall. Well, a couple things I'll point out. Ideally, the most sustainable way to lay out a building in terms of solar orientation is to have the long axis going east-west, because the south sun is much more manageable than the east or west. So once the sun goes quite low, especially in the west, it's very difficult to combat that. So in this case, we do have more of an east-west exposure, but we had a bit of a dilemma because the view is actually to the east, to the tower. So we wanted to allow for a view to the tower, but not open up too much there. These small apertures as windows in the north were more to do with privacy for the residents. So being on a very exposed corner, you're able to have smaller, a little more privacy. And then there was also a concept of that being a bit of a thickened wall that allows for storage within it. So let's, you can see a bit here in that space where you're able to store walls. And we start to have a couple storage and display in an interesting way. And these are those vertical windows, and then the view to the east. So this is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek gesture at the moment, to be honest, but by having some sliding louvers, you begin to mitigate at least somewhat the morning sun if you want to block that out, but then you can open it up later in the afternoon or the evening if you want to. One of the main features of the house and one of the larger principles of sustainability is trying to be as flexible as possible. And so Michael Braungart, who wrote Cradle to Cradle, talks about that we don't know exactly what the right thing to do is ever. We don't know if we're designing the right thing. There might be something better. We might realize what we're doing is doing some harm down the road. So what you try to do is just try to not do anything that's irreversible. Everything you do, you try to make it that it can be undone. And so one of those strategies when that comes to architectural principles is being as flexible as possible and having, for example, as open of a plan as possible. And that's quite difficult on a 20 by 80 foot lot. But in this case, getting back to the core, the vertical circulation core, there was a notion of trying to contain everything that's fixed pretty much right there and allowing everything else could be completely open so that as this changed from lab to residence, it didn't involve tearing out a bunch of materials and having to worry about reuse of those, recycle of those. So the adaptability was a big struggle here. Just lastly here, I want to mention what interesting dilemma that architects come across is trying to convey your concept or trying to get across what it is you're after. And one, obviously, logos and branding are a critical part of that. So for this project, we termed it the Living Lab. I should also mention, I didn't mention previously, but that Professor Uli Dongle and I have collaborated on this with some engineering faculty as well, Attila Novoselok, and then also Tammy Glass, an interior designer, has contributed as well. But what we found interesting about this logo is that we were able to capture the notion of house and home with this childlike vision of a house for the letter A, but then actually refer to it actually being a laboratory. So as I mentioned, it's meant to both be a bit of a model in terms of massing and in terms of material choice. I haven't even mentioned the PV strategy and the electric vehicles that we have that we've acquired to be used as well. But it's also the research is very specific about domestic research and a home research lab. So, for example, it's part of a clean energy smart grid project, which I didn't get into too much either, which deals with a two-way energy system where you're able to sell extra power back to the grid when you harvest enough sunlight and you're able to have enough power. You can sell that back to the grid. And then also, we're developing essentially technologies where you can, from your smartphone, you'd be able to understand exactly where you're using all of your energy, how much that costs. And so, for example, if you leave town for the weekend and then you realize that you didn't set your AC, you didn't adjust your thermostat, you could do that remotely and understand that you would save $18.43 by changing it to X temperature. Or you could set a budget for yourself that you want to spend no more than $45 in your electric bill this month, and then allow your house to then give you the amount of AC that you would get for that amount. You can then override it, of course. But having we feel that by having that one-to-one understanding of your usage would be much more useful. Because if you imagine going to a grocery store and you just buy everything, and at the end they just tell you a price, we'd find that very disturbing. That's exactly what happens with our electric bills and our energy bills, where we don't know how much we're consuming. We don't know how that partitions and breaks down. So that's a lot of the research that's going on here is understanding how to make that interface very understandable and making the graphics of it and the dashboard, if you imagine, of each of those systems so you can understand the difference between washing your dishes in the afternoon is more expensive than washing them late at night, for example. That's when the peak load is hitting. So there are all these things that people don't actually realize. That people don't actually realize their energy consumption and their energy footprint. So that was a very large part of this project as well. So lastly, I just wanted to wrap up to mention that this is obviously sort of a quick sampling of a few things, but that really a lot of what we do as architects is beginning to understand problems, or how you problematize something is very important. You have to understand what you're going to try to solve. And you don't just solve it by, if you're given a program and you just create X number of space and you've created that space. You often want to have some sort of concept, and obviously a consciousness of the energy being used.
May I please, could Renita 40 come to the checkout desk? Renita 40, please come to the checkout desk. Thank you.
So there are a lot of different things going on, and this has a lot to do with architecture being somewhere between art and engineering, where you're concerned about both aesthetics and performance, where traditionally those two fields have been quite different. So we're very interested in at least I am, my own research, of trying to couple the two. So that's it. Thanks.
Okay, so if you have any questions, now's the time. Raise your hand. I'll be coming around with the microphone. And also, where you're sitting, you probably noticed that you have some feedback forms. So we'd like to have those back from you at the end of the program. So who's got a question?
Yeah, hi, Matt. I have a question about vertical gardens. You see these quite a lot in European countries, like they've got them inside Heathrow. There are hotels in London that have them, and museums and galleries. How common are they in the U.S.?
Vertical gardens actually aren't very common. One large reason, and this is a reason why a lot of things exist as they are in the U.S., is just access to land, or we constantly expand. Everyone expects to have their own proper lawn and their own fence in their own yard. So we've never strived for a density that requires it, I think, is the main reason. There are also climatic reasons as well. There is obviously in London, the weather is much more amenable. It's to many different types of species of ivy, for example, that can grow on a vertical wall. So you're more limited in your choices here. But I think the main reason is that people haven't needed to be haven't needed to have ingenuity in the U.S. just because we've always just kept expanding. And of course, has largely to do with the fact that many of our cities are planned around the car instead of around the pedestrian and that sort of thing. So I think that's really the main driver. And then also just a general interest in Europe in terms of seeking sustainable methods. There's a larger, as we all know, there's a huge camp in this country that doesn't even believe that climate change is true. So there's a lot of, there's some reticence from many different parties to actually try to invest in these technologies. So that's a good question.
I happen to notice in the slide of the honeycomb structure, there was a lovely overhang on the roof of the building it's close by that shaded down three stories.
Right.
What's wrong with plain old overhangs? The honeycomb was fun and nice and probably gave you a little bit better quality light, but the overhang seemed to work pretty well, too.
Overhangs are certainly a very tried and true vernacular strategy. And overhangs do work quite well. I didn't mention in the beginning that this particular application was thinking about commercial or large-scale facades. And so I was interested in trying to stay within a relative constrained thickness. But yes, overhangs and eaves work very well on the domestic level. And this, even here, we were constrained. You know, even this is really a tongue-in-cheek gesture, really. But even just those little moves make a pretty big. Let me go back one more. Make a pretty big difference there. Right, so in this application, I wouldn't have done something like that. So it was more to do with the scalar issue, which is, again, I apologize for sampling through these really quickly. It was more to do with the scalar issue than it was to do with a negation of that vernacular strategy.
Hi, Matt. I have a quick question about the economics involved with sustainability and how I'm a firm believer that once it becomes more economical for the general mass to start demanding these things, then the construction industry and everybody else might start taking this more as a norm. And I'm wondering about your particular projects. Was economics investigated in your projects?
Actually, no. I'll repeat the question. The question was about the economics of sustainable construction or sustainable technologies, and the fact that the question suggested that the cost of sustainable technologies will probably come down quite a lot once they become more mainstream, but it hasn't quite reached that tipping point. I'm adding that. She didn't say that, but basically. That's very much the case. That's exactly why the government had rebates for PV panels to encourage people to actually invest in solar panels for their houses, so that the market would then begin to diversify quite a lot and the price would come down. And that did happen. It came down quite a lot, but it's still not quite down enough to where it's reachable for many sectors of the population. So that hasn't been a part of my studies, to answer your question. Specifically, but I'm very acutely aware of this problem, and it's something I do think about quite a lot. And I think that it inevitably will need to happen, because currently, as you suggest, the building industry is very set in their ways, and they're very set in doing things the way they've always done them. And until there's enough demand from the consumers to actually insist upon sustainable technologies, things such as PV panels. That's an easy target, PV panels. So things such as PV panels, as soon as they're insisted upon enough, and it just makes complete sense in this climate especially, there's so much sun. It doesn't make as much sense in London, but they still have many more in London than they do here. So it's unbelievable to me that this happens, but it is very much an issue of time and the market adjusting. And I think there is a tipping point that will happen, but in terms of, I haven't studied exactly when that would arrive. Well, thanks to the UT libraries. Okay. Yeah.
So I agree that a structure like you see here, I'm not sure if it's a wall or a window, leads to a much more sustainable local environment. But of course, it's much more complicated than just building a flat window or a wall, probably much more costly. So is this somehow factored into the sustainability argument of structures like this?
The thought is that this sort of thing would be, this gets a bit back to the previous question, that it does depend upon mass construction for this to actually begin to work. And so the initial thrust of this study was meant to be something that would be prefabricated and mass-produced in extremely high quantities to a point where it would be competitive with any other wall framing system. But it's a very valid point, because and ultimately, this is keep it. So these past two questions are coming back to the same thing. We ultimately always come back to this life cycle issue. So for example, the difference between buying you can buy a light bulb for, let's say, $5 that will last 1 year, and you can buy a light bulb for $10 that will last 20 years. Obviously, it makes more sense to buy the light bulb that costs $10 that will last 20 years, and the light bulb that's $5 that will last 1 year. But there are people that just don't have the money probably not an appropriate example, but the people just don't have the money to make that initial investment. And so this is, again, where the government rebates have come in to try to help with this, but there still is a gap. And so that hasn't been a specific part of my research down to actually quantity surveying and actually doing cost estimation. But so it does have a bit of an assumption that this would need to work, but it hasn't. Well, so for example, the honeycomb system was built for $1,500, for example. So this system actually is something that's not any more expensive than buying vertical or horizontal louvers aluminum louvers that you would buy somewhere. So that certainly was a factor here, But then for this next one, it's a little more speculative. That wasn't as much of a driving factor. It's a good question. Okay. Thanks to UT Libraries for having me, and thanks for sitting in, everyone. I appreciate it.